This is The Front Porch on New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Shay Zeller. A few years after the end of the Civil War, a day was established to honor those who had died serving their country. We now know it as Memorial Day, and sometimes it's still referred to by its original name, Decoration Day. Tonight on The Front Porch, we're going to step into the Memorial Day weekend with some history, some veteran stories, and a look at how the culture and traditions of memorials themselves have changed over the years. My first guest is Rick Beyer. He's a documentary producer and author of The Greatest War Stories Never Told, 100 Tales from Military History to Astonish, Bewilder, and Stupefy. Rick, welcome back to The Front Porch.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Let's start by talking about Arlington National Cemetery in Washington, which you write about in your book. More than 300,000 U.S. veterans are buried there. It's a sacred place for many people. You point out that it was initiated out of spite. What happened there?
Well, it involves a man named Montgomery Meigs, who's Quartermaster General of the U.S. Army during the Civil War. And before the war, he was good friends with Robert E. Lee, and he had a reason to be angry at him. I mean, they'd known each other, they'd worked together in the Army, and now Lee is heading up this Confederate Army that's killing a lot of Union soldiers. And every day when Montgomery Meigs walks to work in Washington, he can see Robert E. Lee's house sitting up there on a hill in Arlington looking down as if it's mocking him. So he gets the idea that sort of the perfect act of, I don't know, you want to call it vengeance or revenge, would be to turn Lee's house and yard, his grounds there, into a cemetery. And he does this in 1864 and turns it into a cemetery for Union dead. And he's really angry at Lee, and when they're not burying people close enough to the house, he actually goes up there and personally supervises the burial of 26 soldiers in Mary Lee's Rose Garden. He really wants to make it so that the Lees can never return here. This is no longer can be their home. And this is greatly approved by Northern newspapers, who say, well, this is a perfect use for, you know, the rebel general's house and yard. By the end of 1864, there are 7,000 soldiers, Union dead, buried in Robert E. Lee's grounds. And through this act of vengeance, it leads to what is now essentially a national shrine, probably the closest thing we have to sacred ground in America.
And where were Robert and Mary Lee when this was going on?
Well, they were, Robert E. Lee was heading up the Confederate Army, so he was in various places, leading the Confederates against the Union Army in Virginia. Mary Lee was hiding out, or I should say she was not hiding out, but she was staying in Richmond, Virginia, and at various other places with friends during the Civil War.
So nobody was there to protect the house?
Well, no, and the house really, the government took it. They said, oh, Robert E. Lee's not paying his taxes, which he really couldn't do since he was actually fighting a rebellion against the Union government. So they took the house. They had already taken the house from him, in essence, and taken it over as an army post. But it was really Meg's idea to really sort of salt the earth, if you will, and turn it into a burial ground.
Any sense of how they felt about that? I'm sure they were upset. They must have lived the rest of their lives knowing that their house was now a burial ground for soldiers.
Well, in fact, we know how Mary Lee felt. She said that she was devastated to find that the house was now, quote, surrounded by the graves of those who aided to bring all the ruin on the children and the country. So they were angry because, of course, I think especially Mary Lee, to the end of her life, you know, fiercely defended the Confederate cause, and I think that they felt that they had been sort of doubly wronged here, wronged by the country that they rebelled against and wronged personally by what was done to their property and grounds.
Were any Confederates ever buried there?
Yes, there are Confederates buried there. I don't know how many. I do know that there are only two Confederate generals who are buried there. But I don't know how many Confederates overall are buried there.
One of those is General Joe Wheeler. What can you tell us about him?
Well, Joe Wheeler is a fascinating character, and he was a very short guy, so maybe it's appropriate that he has one of the tallest obelisks in Arlington Cemetery.
Hello, Napoleon and
yeah, exactly.
All over Paris, they have these wonderful monuments to the short Napoleon.
Napoleon's burial coffin, it could fit entire families into it, probably about 20 Napoleons. But in the case of Joe Wheeler, very interesting that 30 or so years after the Civil War, he actually becomes a general for the U.S. Army. He's a powerful congressman at this point. When war breaks out with Spain in 1898, he is appointed a U.S. general to lead volunteers down in the fight fighting in Cuba. And Joe Wheeler is he's there at the Battle of San Juan Hill, where he's reportedly shouting to his troops, you know, "Come on, boys, we got the damn Yankees on the run again." A little confused, I think, at that point about who the Yankees actually were in that particular conflict.
A little projecting there on his part, I guess.
Yeah, I guess, you know, once you have one enemy, you kind of keep the name in your mind for your whole life.
Now, I read that there were also former slaves buried there.
There are, and in fact, there were slaves buried in Arlington Cemetery, I believe, before there were even soldiers buried there. It started, and that may have been one of the things that gave Montgomery Meigs the idea of burying soldiers there, is because some slaves had been buried there, because there was a shanty town on the property about a mile or so from the house where slaves gathered during the early years of the Civil War.
What do you find most interesting about Arlington National Cemetery?
Well, there's all sorts of stories sort of embedded in Arlington Cemetery. And I think what's interesting to me is you can sort of see things on the surface, but like so many things in our country, if you can get past the surface and look at the history of it, you'll see sort of all sorts of fascinating stories. And an example would be, how often have we seen the scene where somebody is playing taps at a funeral at Arlington Cemetery? And yet, do you ever stop to think where taps came from and how it became the song that it is? And it happened during the Civil War in 1862, and it involves another Civil War general whose name is Dan Butterfield, a Union general, and he's unhappy with the calls that are being played for Lights Out. So he calls the bugler into his tent, and Dan Butterfield doesn't know any music at all, but he calls the bugler into his tent, Oliver Norton, and he says, I have an idea for what we ought to be playing at night. I want something more musical and more of a nighttime sense, and let me whistle it for you. So he starts kind of whistling it out, and you have this scene on a warm July evening in the army camp of the general whistling and the bugler blowing, and eventually he's happy with it. Oliver Norton goes back, plays the song that night. The other buglers from other units say, "Well, that's really great. Can we learn it?" They learn it. It spreads to both armies. And now, of course, it's ubiquitous. And it's played there at those funerals, and yet we never even realize sort of the origins of the song and the interesting story behind it.
It is such an interesting story, and it's such a haunting melody that it's interesting that it comes from somebody who's a New York business guy turned Union general.
Right, and a guy who many people took a dim view of. Now, he did win the Medal of Honor for leading troops in battle, but he was also referred to by one of his fellow officers as a man of blemished character. But I guess he had a little bit of poetry in his soul.
This is The Front Porch on New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Shay Zeller. And tonight we're looking ahead to Memorial Day by looking at the history of famous monuments. Joining me right now is Rick Beyer. He's the author of The Greatest War Stories Never Told. Among the famous memorials near Arlington National Cemetery is the statue depicting the raising of the flag at Iwo Jima. And that statue is, of course, based on the famous photo of that event. As famous as the photo is, I understand it was sort of a happy accident that it was ever taken. What happened?
Well, it's truly an amazing story. Joe Rosenthal is the AP photographer who took that photo. And the story of that day, he's first of all, as he lands on Iwo Jima, he falls out of the landing boat. He's almost killed getting ashore. And then he's looking for things. He's under deadline. He's looking for things to take pictures of. And he finds out that there's supposed to be a flag raising on the top of Mount Suribachi. But, hey, Joe, you probably already missed it. Well, he decides to head up Mount Suribachi anyway. And he goes up with a group of soldiers. And they're coming under heavy fire. This is still a lot of fighting going on. They get about halfway up, and some of the people coming down say, "Oh yeah, that flag raising, it already took place. So you've already missed it. We got some great pictures. Too bad." And Joe Rosenthal thinks about turning around at that point, but he decides not to, which turns out to be a very, very lucky decision. And he gets to the top, and he discovers that, indeed, they had raised a flag, but they're taking that flag down because there's a Marine officer who wants it as a souvenir, and so they're putting up another flag. And they're also putting up a bigger flag this time. And so he's trying to get his camera in position to take the picture, and he's putting it on top of this, making a little pile of stones, and he puts the camera on top of it to get it positioned. And he's not even looking through the viewfinder, and he sees out of the corner of his eye that they're getting the flag up a little quicker than he thought they were going to, and he pushes the button without even looking through the viewfinder. And at that point, of course, he does not know at that point that he's taken, you know, this incredible picture. He goes on and he takes some other pictures. The film goes back to the lab. The frames 9 and 11 on this roll of film are destroyed by light leaks to the camera. They're just completely blank. And frame 10 in the middle is this picture, which, of course, is one of the most famous war pictures ever taken, I would think. And there's a New York Times editor sees it when it comes over the wire that night, and he says, essentially, this is one for the ages. And yeah, so it's not just one lucky accident, it's all those lucky accidents. It's almost as if that it was ordained to be taken, that somehow it was going to happen despite everything.
He wins a Pulitzer Prize for that picture too, doesn't he?
He won the Pulitzer Prize, and I think his career was made with that picture. Didn't even look through the lens when he took it.
Well, Rick, what will you be thinking about this Memorial Day?
Well, I'll be thinking about some of my own family members who have served in the military over the years, most of whom survived their military experiences, but still fought for their country. And I'll be thinking, too, of a gentleman named Jonathan Harrington. I live in Lexington, Massachusetts, and Jonathan Harrington is one of the men who stood on the green in Lexington, Massachusetts on April 19th, 1775, and was mortally wounded by a British musket ball on the first day of the American Revolution. And Jonathan Harrington lived in a house at the end of the green, and he crawled back to his house to try to get back there, and he died on his own doorstep, with his wife and children looking on, one of the very first people to be killed in the fight for independence and to help give birth to our country. So I'll be thinking of him as well.
Well, Rick, thank you for helping us remember.
My pleasure.
Rick Beyer is the author of The Greatest War Stories Never Told, 100 Tales from Military History to Astonish, Bewilder, and Stupefy. He's also a producer of a number of documentaries, and he's currently working on Godspeed to Jamestown, about a replica of the ship that carried people to Jamestown. You'll find a link to his website on the front porch section of nhpr.org. This is The Front Porch on New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Shay Zeller. Memorial Day, of course, has become synonymous with the beginning of summer. It brings to mind images of picnics and backyard barbecues. But the holiday holds more somber recollections for those who observe its official meaning. The weekend can be especially poignant for those who've served in the military and lost friends on the battlefield. This year, many will remember those soldiers who've fallen in Iraq or Afghanistan. We visited VFW Post 1631 in Concord, New Hampshire, to talk with some of the people who fought in previous wars.
Memorial Day to me is a very solemn type time. You know, look back, reflect on those who didn't come back. You know, those were the true heroes. You know. So you reflect on those. Lost a couple of good friends over there. So. They were my tent mates over in Korea and one in Japan. You know, lost them to losing a helicopter one time on a search and rescue mission. Chopper went down. We lost a couple of pilots and the crew chief, who was my friend. So these are people that, you know, I served with.
I served from 1966 to 70, being in Vietnam. Tet 68 to 69. The one guy was the reason I went. Wounded once, went back. Wounded again, lost his leg, and died on the hospital ship. And it just tore me apart. There was a dozen of them by the time it was over. These were all guys that I grew up with in Philadelphia, you know. And I couldn't live in Philly anymore after losing all those friends.
I got out in 1945, and we fought for a good many years over in the Philippines and all the South Pacific. We had a lot of action, I agree with that. We was in there quite a while. I think we were the longest outfit that stayed in the front lines for quite a while. We were in there for, we went in with 92 men. We come out with, I think it was 72 left out of the whole outfit. So and most of my friends are gone. Yeah, a lot of my buddies that I lost over there, and there's quite a few. I got wounded once, but not bad. Just went, bullet went through my helmet and out around the back. I thought I got it, but just went through right around the lining, out the back. It's just burning sensation all the way around my head, and ears burnt, and everything. When you scared the hell out of me, though, let's put it that way. I was really scared, but so that's about all I can say. But that I was glad I was a veteran, and I'm glad that I served.
That's World War II veteran Edward Miller. We also heard from Vietnam veteran Bill Lackey and Korean War veteran John Fink. We spoke with them at VFW Post 1631 in Concord, New Hampshire. This is The Front Porch on New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Shay Zeller. In a minute, we'll talk about the history of memorials and how they reflect the culture of the people who build them. In the meantime, we'd like to hear from you. What or who will you be thinking about this Memorial Day? Do you visit a certain memorial on a frequent basis, and why? Call our listener line and share your stories, memories, and thoughts, and we'll include them. We'll include your comments and stories on Monday's show. The listener line is 603-223-2473. That's 603-223-2473. Remember, your memorial stories will be on Monday on The Front Porch. This is The Front Porch on New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Shay Zeller, and we're looking ahead to Memorial Day on tonight's show. My next guest has studied and written about memorials of all kinds, with an eye towards the culture and tradition of how they're created. Simon J. Bronner is Distinguished Professor of Folklore and American Studies at Penn State in Harrisburg. Professor Bronner, welcome to The Front Porch.
Good to be here.
Memorials used to be erected mainly to honor people who died serving their country, but when did we start seeing them created to honor not just the war dead?
You really start seeing that after the Civil War for a lot of reasons. One of them is increasing American mobility and the idea that people wanted to erect monuments for those that they remember from previous places, and also the idea that increasingly people were dying, in their viewpoint, away from home. And so the ideas of erecting memorials start emerging, too, with getting away from the idea of the standard grave marker and the idea of creating memorials and cemeteries, and then that started moving over to public spaces, actually later in the century, and with that, the idea of a decoration day and then a Memorial Day starts evolving after the Civil War as well.
What are some of those memorials out there that are not dedicated to veterans?
You get a lot of memorials to firefighters. You get memorials also to police officers. You also get some memorials to significant local figures, and usually with the idea that they have some kind of heroic status, which is especially problematic in the United States because of a lack of a nobility. So these heroic status start serving the function of recognizing people who go above and beyond for the help of the common people. One of the, I think, things that separate memorials in the United States from Europe, for example.
In Europe, often writers are memorialized with statues in a town square or, you know, a big monument in a town. Do we have things like that in America?
We do, but not to the same extent, partly because of the connection of many writers in Europe to celebrations of a local place. So that if you go to Edinburgh, Scotland, for example, Sir Walter Scott is something of a national hero for creating a national literature. And that isn't seen the same way in the United States, although there are
memorials to Nathaniel Hawthorne, and especially in New England, for example, there is a sense of an American literature that comes out of that early period, but they tend to be much later.
Now, the Vietnam Memorial was installed in 1982. It was highly controversial because of its underground design and its starkness. How did it become so popular?
I think it became popular, one, because of the rendering of names. Many memorials of a mass scale such as that would usually be thematic or have iconography that was very general that people may not have related to because of that they knew someone who was involved. So the names and being able to relate to the individual is something of a modern movement in memorials, and I think it reflected that trend. But what probably made it the most distinctive is its interactive basis, the idea that people brought things to the wall, perhaps because it looked like a wall in which it was almost a blank canvas except for these names starkly embedded in black. And at first, in fact, the Park Service didn't know quite what to do with all these things that were brought, boots and flowers and screen doors and cards. This is really a prelude to later on what we think of as spontaneous shrines for tragedies, and I think it really begins. But then the Park Service started encouraging this as a way to make this indeed a public space in which people can express themselves in a personal way rather than in an official way waiting for some ceremony. This is a way people relate to death and honor and respect in, I think, in our postmodern age.
So do you think the Vietnam Memorial in some way changed the way we started creating monuments?
I think absolutely, because then you can look at places like Oklahoma City, for example, and even now in New York City, and there's more of an expected behavior that memorials are not going to be cordoned off and memorials are not going to be sheltered on some pedestal, but in fact invite this notion of a public who are able to express themselves in personal and in diverse ways.
Yeah, I believe in Oklahoma, is there a chair, or a stone chair for each person who died in the bombing?
There is, and people bring things to it. And there are others, even more traditional memorials that have started to be more accepting of this. For example, in Holocaust memorials that once were seen as very blank and stark, and we're seeing more of those now with people bringing things to them. In Pearl Harbor, which once was a place to see, but not necessarily to memorialize materially, now there are more of these kinds of interactive behaviors going on.
Well, you bring up an interesting point. We were talking earlier about different kinds of monuments. We mentioned people who were, you know, public servants, but you just mentioned the Holocaust. I think of a monument that I saw in Boston, which is dedicated to the Irish people who died in the so-called potato famine. What kinds of things dictate the scope of a memorial if it's honoring a particular group?
Often there's a cultural context and what the group wants to symbolize from that experience. Also in Boston, there is a Holocaust memorial that many people probably pass by because it's in glass, but the idea that is that you are encouraged to walk within it, to feel enclosed. That's one strategy. Rather than having a public art that's meant to be viewed, this is one that's meant to be experienced. And very often with Holocaust memorials, you see the idea of a hand emerging, the idea of reaching out, of in fact a regeneration through a tragedy. And there's some of that actually in the Oklahoma City commemoration as well, that it's been destroyed, but rather than seeing it as an empty plot of land, there's this idea that there's going to be some kind of rebirth from it as well.
What's the thinking behind the placement of memorial? You want to put it in the right place.
Yeah, that's a very interesting question because that has changed. The old thinking used to be that you placed a memorial either on the site of a tragedy, and this is especially true in many Catholic areas because of this belief that the site of a tragedy becomes hallowed or spiritual ground. And yet that gave way to the idea that a memorial would be in a community or an enclave from that ethnicity or the audience particularly affected by the tragedy. So you would have the Irish memorial that you mentioned in a Irish community or an enclave. But increasingly, I would say, since the 1960s, there's been this idea of public art and, in fact, a kind of public marketplace with memorials vying for attention to certain groups and certain events that the designers want you to remember. So increasingly, they're on waterfronts or they're in downtowns with the idea this is the place of hustle and bustle and where the populace meets and mixes, and this is a way to separate out the different identities in that particular community. But sometimes it can be competitive for those spaces. There isn't always a consensus over what is the kind of memorialization and the extent of it once you start with it.
Well, before we go, we're almost out of time, but what are the most critical things that you think we can include in memorials being designed today that best represent these times, the times we live in?
I think one aspect is thinking about the future. Many of the older memorials were primarily concerned about recounting what happened in the past, and increasingly we see memorials that have some message about what we've learned from either a person, group, or experience for the future. The other is an interactive aspect, so that memorials invite ceremonies, they invite custom, they invite ritual for people to relate to it in this hustle and bustle age.
Well, Simon, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're quite welcome.
Have a nice Memorial Day.
Thank you.
Simon Bronner is Distinguished Professor of Folklore and American Studies at Penn State in Harrisburg. You can find links to him and Penn State on the Front Porch section of nhpr.org. The Front Porch is produced by Andrew Walsh and Liz Balkley.